Welcome to The World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process, hosted by Edward Willems. This episode's guest, Julie Schoenaeder. Welcome to The World Shapers. I'm your host, Edward Willett. I write science fiction and fantasy, and in this podcast, I do something that I've always enjoyed doing, which is talk to other writers of science fiction and fantasy about their creative process. I'll just give you a quick rundown of my own work. The most recent book is World Shapers. It is my 9th novel for New York Staw Books, one of the major science fiction and fantasy publishers. And yes, that is the book from which this podcast gets its name. It launches a new series called, oddly enough, World Shapers. I hope you'll check that out. My previous book was a standalone science fiction novel, a rare thing these days, it sometimes seems, called The City Born, and that's now out in mass market paperback. A couple of other things I like to mention are my young adult fantasy series called Shards of Excalibur. That's a 5-book series, and it came out from Kato Books in print and ebook. And the audiobooks are just now coming out. They'll all be out by the end of 2018. They are narrated by the wonderful Elizabeth Klett. I have a recent collection of science fiction and fantasy poetry, of all things, called I Tumble Through the Diamond Dust, beautifully illustrated by Alberta artist Wendy Nordell. That was published by Your Nicholsworth Publishing, also available in both print and ebook and audiobook. And finally, I just released a collection of my short fiction called Paths to the Stars. That's published by Shadowpaw Press and is also available in both print and ebook formats. And that, without a doubt, is enough about me. Let's get on to the meat of this podcast, the interview with an author. My guest this episode is Julie Schoenaeder, and let me give you a brief introduction of this fascinating person. Julie Schoenaeder was born in Exeter, Ontario, and she grew up on Air Force bases because her military family. Her family moved quite a bit, transferring from Ontario to Prince Edward Island and Nova Scotia. And when her father became a civilian, they came back to Ontario, settling in what was then a rural setting near the shores of Lake Ontario, and is now that not-so-rural setting known as Mississauga. Julie studied biology at the universities of Waterloo, Saskatchewan, and Queens in Kingston, and then accompanied by her former chemistry partner and now husband, so I guess you could say there was real chemistry between them, Roger, they moved a few times before settling back in Ontario, where they still live. Julie began her writing career in educational publishing, something I know something about because I've done a lot of work in that field as well. She became a full-time author and editor of nonfiction educational materials in 1985, but at the same time, she was writing unfinished science fiction novels. She had 23 of them tucked away, and it took encouragement from her husband and her nonfiction publisher to finish the longest, Beholder's Eye, which was eventually picked up by Daw Books. And that very same year, Julie was a finalist for the John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer. Daw contracted for 3 more novels, and she hasn't looked back since. She's been published by Daw ever since. I think it's up to 18 novels. Is that right?
I think 19 is about to come out.
Including the popular 9-book Clan Chronicles series. She's also written many, many short stories, edited anthologies, taught writing, and has received international acclaim, multiple awards, and best-selling status. So, welcome, Julie.
Thank you. Hi, welcome, Ed. One quick edit, if I may, because, you know, I did a lot of editing in my time, too. It was 1,000 Words for Stranger was the longest one. It was Story X in my folder, and that's the one that was the first one. Beholder's Eye came out next, and it was actually Story 3 in my stack. So there you go.
Well, I thought I was doing pretty, well, not good, pretty badly with about 12 unpublished novels before I published anything, but you had me beat there.
Well, I was just writing them for my own fun. It was like going to watch TV, you turn on a show you liked. Well, I would just pick up the story I liked and putter at it. I had no thought of publishing them at all. That was never the plan.
Well, in the interest of full disclosure, I should point out that we are both members of the Daw family of authors.
Woohoo!
And we also share an editor, the inimitable and Hugo Award-winning Sheila E. Gilbert. So we're actually going to talk about the editing process a little bit later on. I'll be interested to see how your experience with Daw editing matches up with mine. Pretty close, I would think.
She was terrifying.
Yeah. We're also going to focus, usually in these podcasts, I focus on a published novel, but we're going to talk a little bit more about your work in progress, your fantasy work in progress, Mage, which will be interesting because from what I can tell from what you've written about it, it's quite different from your usual book. So it'll be interesting to compare and contrast there. But first, let's go back into the mists of time. And how did you become interested in science fiction and why?
Two things happened. I was 10 and I'd run out of books to read. So I started reading every book that had an author was with the last name beginning with N, because that's the shelf I could reach most easily in the school library. And I read a lot of terrible books. And then I hit Andre Norton. And I came home and I talked to my father after reading this. I said, this is the best stuff ever. I mean, it's imaginative, far reaching. It's aliens. And he said, oh, that's science fiction. I'll start bringing it home for you. So then he did, because he grew up on the pulps. He was a big fan of Burroughs and all these other writers at the time. And so I got it, you know, he was excited that I'd found it. I was thrilled I'd found it myself too. So it never stopped at that point.
That was one of my favorites as well. Andre Norton was certainly a big influence on me. Moon of Three Rings and
yes.
All those great books. Did you become interested in writing after that? Was that an impetus in becoming interested in writing and telling stories? Was the stories that you read?
Not so much. It was, again, I think my father and my mother conspired on me, because my dad would pick up books for me on paydays, because that's when you had a little bit extra, and he would come home on the go train. He'd stop at the local bookstore and he'd pick up what he could find. And he brought me home. I mean, that's how I got all the Narnia books, and I've got a huge collection of Doc Savage. And he started me on Tarzan. So he brought me home the first two Tarzan books, but he only gave me the first one. And so I read it. And if you've ever read the first Tarzan novel, it doesn't end well. I mean, Tarzan he doesn't get the girl. He doesn't get the money. He goes skulking back into the jungle while his Weasley cousin gets it all. I was so furious. I came running out yelling, and I never did that. So instead of explaining to me what a cliffhanger was, my mom lent me her typewriter and said, fix it. So I took the typewriter, which was much larger than me, back into my room, and I pounded away. I didn't even know how to type. And I wrote a horrible page, which was much more satisfying to me than the book. And I never stopped. Even though I did read the sequel and quite liked it, I like my version too.
So did you write a lot as a kid?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. My parents bought me a filing cabinet. Nice big secondhand filing cabinet. I wore out my share of ribbons on the typewriter.
One of the interesting things about your background is the moving from military base to military base. And, you know, a lot of science fiction writers, and I found this with just about everybody I've talked to so far for this podcast, has a kind of a history of not quite fitting in when they were kids. In my case, it was a move from Texas to Saskatchewan when I was 8. And I also skipped a grade, so I was always the youngest in my class. And that certainly contributed to my reading in general, and I think somewhat to the science fiction and fantasy side of things. Did that have any influence on you?
I guess part of it was when we left the Air Force, we moved into a civilian neighborhood, and all the kids were gone all summer at cottages. I'd never even heard of that before. So I was alone from that point of view, but I'd already developed a great love of reading and horseback riding and just roaming around in nature. So I'm not so sure I used it to fill in a social gap so much as I was just so excited that I had time to do it, because school was coming and I wouldn't have as much time to do it. So my parents would be, I would go to the library every week, and I would bring out, you know, at first the librarians were very doubtful that I was reading that many books a week, and then they realized, yes, I was. So it was okay.
What I got was my mother, the librarian at the Weyburn Public Library in Saskatchewan told my mother, your son, 12-year-old me or 10-year-old me, is checking books out from the adult side of the library.
Just hide them there. Yes.
And my mother said, it's okay. He only reads science fiction. And I don't think she knew what was in some of the books that I was reading. But
very true. Very true. No, and then I, you know, you get to a point when I got to university, I discovered they had a science fiction section. And I'd never seen brand new science fiction books except what my dad brought me home from Toronto. So to be able to buy them myself was liberating.
Did your libraries have the little stickers with the rocket ship inside the model of an atom on the back of it? There was a little yellow
They did.
sticker.
And they also, at the beginning, you wrote your name in on the card. And so there were some books that over the course of 3 or 4 years, I was the only one taking them out.
Now, when you went on into university, you went into science, into biology specifically. Mm-hmm. Did your interest in science arise at all from your interest in science fiction?
I think science fiction was a more logical, well, not logical. It seemed like a lot of things I read as a kid were finite. They just ended, or they were real life. And while real life is marvelous, I'd rather talk to real people about it. So when I discovered things that were showing me something beyond what was here, it was the same itch being scratched that takes me into science. So I think that they're actually the same thing. I go into science because I want to explore how the world works. I read science fiction because I want new, interesting ways of thinking about the world. So they went hand in hand, and fantasy much the same reason. I just have a very active imagination. I always have had, and I just have very little patience for things that don't, if that makes any sense.
Why did you choose biology specifically?
Oh, well, initially I was going to go into a joint one with physics, and I was going to be the first person to go into space who was equipped to actually communicate with aliens, because I would have the technology and I would have the knowledge of animal behavior. So this was a good plan, and I wrote it out when I was in grade 3. But I did actually try to take a joint degree in physics because I was fascinated with space as well, in physics and biology. But they weren't set up for that back in the day. So my courses conflicted. I had Red Ink. No one had conflicted so many courses in once as I had that first year at Waterloo. They brought me into the office to congratulate me for that. But I loved all the sciences. Biology always has been my favorite. The natural world is my passion. But I tried to always take as many things as I could because I wanted to know them all. And at some point you have to specialize. It's a shame. But I still to this day try to generalize more.
You have mentioned, too, that some of your early science fiction writing while you were studying biology or as a biologist was as kind of a thought experiment to consider ideas that you couldn't test in the lab.
Oh, yes. I had that model, if you will, before me right away. I mean, especially science fiction shorts that were exploring, what if you crashed on a planet with a methane ocean? This kind of thought experiment you could do in the lab without having to do anything. So I could do all kinds of extrapolations on my ideas, and I believe too, I'm sure there's a lot of science fiction writers who come in and talk to scientists about where their work could go and what hypotheses they could test they might not have thought of because they're not used to thinking quite so far beyond what they've got. And I was already doing that, so it was nice to be able to do those experiments at least in my head.
You mentioned that, of course, you also love fantasy and you're writing fantasy. Mm-hmm. I'm curious. I sometimes find when I'm writing fantasy that there's a scientific piece in the back of my head that says, that you can't do that. the whole magic thing. And it's, and conservation of mass and energy is, of course, one that is frequently violated by magical things. Do you find you have to put something, that kind of little voice aside when you're writing, or do you actually try to make it make some kind of physical sense?
Well, now, when I read fantasy, the best fantasy takes me out of myself. So I don't have that, oh, this isn't real, oh, this couldn't happen, or how would that work? I don't do that. When I'm writing it, I was very hesitant to write it for a long time. None of the pieces of the 23 file folders were fantasy because I just felt that the language was so much richer. The landscapes were so much more intense that I couldn't see myself doing it ever. And actually, it wasn't till I was a DAW author and I was Marty Greenberg asked me, would I write a story for this fantasy anthology? And I went, oh my goodness, you don't say no. So I wrote my first fantasy, and it's probably the most like it's not science fiction. It was not too bad. But when I started thinking about writing anything longer, I was quite terrified. And to actually jump in and write a fantasy novel, it took me about 5 years to work up the courage to start it. And it took me about 2 years and deleting 400,000 words to figure out how.
It's
so no, it's not the same.
It's interesting because, of course, one of the among your most popular books are the ones that feature, do you pronounce it Essen?
Mm-hmm.
You're a shapeshifter. And
yes.
Of course, shapeshifting is something that often can, in magical worlds, violate things like conservation of mass and energy, where something really big becomes something really small.
Yeah.
But you've actually made a point in the science fiction side of things to deal with the physics of that, haven't you?
Oh, yes, yes. It's quite fun and causes the main character all kinds of predicaments, which is what you want in a good story. But also, when I was working on Essen, I just wanted to make a... I didn't really go in there trying to make a shapeshifter. I went in there to make a semi-immortal biological organism. And at the time, the best knowledge that we had was that that would have to involve replacing molecules at the and in within the cells so that none accumulated that were destructive or aged that way. So then I realized if you had that kind of conscious control over your body, why not change it into other things? So that's where that came from. So it really was to have the longevity first, and the shape-shifting just fell from that as a logical progression. Well, at least to me.
Those books are in particular your kind of biological playground, aren't they?
Oh, yes. I have a very large filing cabinet full of weird biology, and all of it goes in those books. Most of the weird stuff is real. It's wonderful.
Well, we're gonna talk about the way that you craft a book and how it all starts. I know that this is a bit of a cliche. It sounds almost like where do you get your ideas, but it's mm-hmm. not quite, because it's not so much where do you get an idea, but what ideas take root. So, what
Perfect.
Typically provides you with the seed from which a novel grows? And you talk about all of your books, but in particular, maybe the work in progress, Mage.
Thank you. Yeah, that's actually a very good case in point, because up to 2008, I had no plans to write a fantasy novel, no credibility to do so. And I had only written short fiction, and I was sort of working my way around in that for fantasy. And then Eric Flint asked me to write a fantasy novella for what was then the Bain online market that they had. And I went, okay. So I was trying to think, what on earth could I do for a fantasy novella? And of course, as one does, I was flipping through the Lee Valley catalog, which is woodworking tools and things like that, as one always does.
Of course.
Of course. And you should read the words. The catalog is fabulous. But I came across this pen, and I looked at it, and I the words they were using, I'd never heard these words before, the parts of the pen. And I was looking this up, and then I did some more research, and all of a sudden I realized that I wanted to write a magic system based on pen and ink.
Hmm.
And so this one image, I still have I clipped it out of the catalog, and if I'd been really smart, I would have ordered the pen, but I forgot. And it led me right through to the main character, because the book opens with the pen in his hand after many, many years of use. And it's the same pen. So that one thing was enough, because then what I did was it going to have enough meat to it? So I went and researched the history of ink, which is full of great drama and crime and all kind manner of skullduggery. It's amazing. So that got me going on that too.
Well, that brings up an interesting question I like to ask as well, is the research process. Do you, it sounded like you did a lot before you were even ready to get started on this one. Is that typical?
It's typical. For Species Imperative, I researched for 5 years before I started the story, as I was working on other things, but that was my research project for 5 years. For Gossamer Mage, because I had a novella and I had a deadline, I was supposed to be writing books at the same time, not so much time. So I focused in on the actual construction of the pens, and I based it fairly loosely, but on regular medieval setting. But then I realized that wasn't going to be quite good enough, because I also wanted to deal with magic as a personification. Mm-hmm. So there's a deathless goddess from which all magic comes. But in this one, I do have an ecological cycle. To her, all magic has to return. So as a mage writes a spell and creates something, they lose some of their life, which flows back to her. So it's a cycle. So you only do magic for a certain amount of time, and then you realize, I don't have enough time left, because I was 20, but now I look 50, and it's only been a year. So this is how it works. So I was able to focus in more on those aspects of it. So it didn't require that much research on my part. For something like the other fantasy, A Turn of Light, where I was setting it in a little village where everything had to be right, like the mill and how it works, what they eat, how many, you know, days of the year there were. That one I did a lot of research ahead of time.
What's your process? Do you read a lot of books? Do you do a lot of online? Where do you find your information when you're researching?
Okay. If it's for science fiction, I tend to know enough about the question I want to ask to get going, and then I know what I need to research. For something I'm not writing for a couple of years, I'm currently researching plate tectonics. So as I go out, I'll talk to people about that in the field. I will make notes of who I should talk to. So I try to do a lot of interviewing of scientists and talking to them for science fiction. I get science news, you know, I keep clippings. For the fantasy, it's far more about the world building, because everything past the world building is me making it up. But the world building has to feel so tight and solid, which in science fiction, you don't have to. You could say you're walking in a starship. People will give you that. But if I say people are walking into like a royal hall or meeting a king's audience, everyone has different ideas of that, and you've got to put it in there. So I need to do that kind of research. And so I like to visit places. So for Turn, there's a lot of log cabins. So I've spent a lot of time in log cabins. I went to a mill and had them, they ran it for me so I could feel how the building shakes and moves as the water starts to hit the turbines. So I like to be as physical into things as I can. And of course you Google stuff when you have to, you're writing away and you go, I must Google this right now.
Do you find that in your research then informs your book as you find things you didn't know before? You think, oh, that's something I can use.
Oh, it's wonderful. For Species Imperative, I wanted to talk about, I wanted to describe, it's not even an important moment, but someone's going down in a submarine to check on an experiment left at the bottom of, just off the Vancouver coast. And so I contacted a scientist who I knew was doing remote sensing, and I said, well, think ahead 300 years, you know, does this sound right? And she says, oh, yes, but then you would also see this coral, which I only just discovered that nobody else knows about yet. And I said, I'm going to put that in the book.
Did it have a name at least?
No, I didn't need to have that because, you know, by then it would have been old hat. So I just, you know, I just said the red coral that everyone knows about down here. So it was, so when you get the chance to, yes.
Yeah, I think my example of that was I had a mine in my Masks trilogy. And
which is amazing.
Oh, thank you. And you know, okay, so you got a bunch of ladders going up and down. Well, that's boring. There must be something more interesting. And so I did some research on older forms of moving people around in mines and this wonderful thing called a man engine with reciprocating platforms driven by a water wheel. And you have to step from one platform to the next to move up and down the levels. And it was both something that I'd never heard of and seemed really cool, but also something that seemed quite terrifying. So, it's wonderful when you can find things like that in the research. So what's your outlining look like, or whatever process you take to prepare to write? Do you do a detailed outline? How does it work for you?
It depends. it really depends. I did nothing to outline for Turn of Light, for example, the big fantasy, my giant, great big one. Didn't need to. I wanted to see where it went. For the next two Essen books, because I'm writing Gossamer Mage first, and I'm writing those next, I wanted to get down as much as I could while it was fresh in my head of what was those were going to look like, their shape, the major plot threads. So I've done that. So they're put away now for a year. For Mage, I'm writing it quite differently than I've written anything else before. It's a series of novellas. So each novella moves the story forward, but each novella can be read separately or in a different order if you wanted to. And so each of those I'm outlining a little bit more tightly so I can make sure I've dotted my I's and crossed my T's. Usually I don't outline till I'm almost finished. And then what I do is I make an outline that I can go back and make sure I've covered every point, if that makes sense. I use it to check myself more than I do to plot to it.
Oh, that's interesting. So it's almost like continuity notes or something.
Yeah.
Make sure you don't miss something.
Well, and it's amazing how quickly you realize that boy, this middle part's really dull because you're just going through it and making notes of what happened. You're saying not a whole lot has happened in these pages, so really don't need those, or more needs to happen there. At one time, I did outline right down to the scene level, and that was because I knew my father was going to come and live with us for a while he recovered from an injury. And so I would have to be leaving the work, coming and going quite often during the day. So what I did was I didn't write a word until I'd written this outline. It's probably about 2 meters by a meter. And I did a grid, and I did every scene, every character, everything was I wrote it that way. Plus, it had to be very detailed because that's the book 3 of the Clan Chronicles. And it had to foreshadow the final 3 books and lead you to the existing 3 books. So it was very complicated. The outline was essential.
I have seen pictures of your workspace, and you seem to be fond of post-it notes and index cards. And
not so much index cards, but definitely I'm a big post-it note consumer.
When you're, sorry, go ahead.
It's like studying for exams, though. And once I put it there, I never go back to it. I mean, I still do it, but it's not as if I refer to it. I just, once I put it down in that format, it still locks it in my head somehow, and I just move away.
So it's just kind of the way you think.
I think so, yeah.
Did you do that in university when you were studying?
Pretty much, yeah. I used to have reams and reams of printer paper, you know, when it used to come out all in one long, you know, fold. I would use the back of that as my study notes. And they get quite elaborate and weird. There were arrows.
I wanted to go back to this whole series thing a little bit. You have a very long series, the 9 books there. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned continuity. Do you find yourself struggling trying to remember things that were in the earlier books as you go along? Because you often write other books in between, I presume.
Oh, well, actually, I started off writing 2 series concurrently. So I would switch from one to the other, back and forth, back and forth. So that was really quite an interesting plan. I do and I don't. It's mostly voice, to make sure that I'm in that voice. Because when I went back to write 3 more books in the Clan Chronicles, it had been over 10 years. And I'd written other things. I'd written third person. So to go back to that voice, I found I actually couldn't do it. I had to just go with a new voice that I invented for myself. And by the time I came to the last 3 books, I felt like I could do it again. But it's more just sounding like it was all written at the same time that matters to me. Because I don't want readers are, like, you know yourself, you get a series, if you can pick them all up and you can read them all at the same time, that's fantastic. But they're not written that way. So for me, it wasn't continuity of fact, because I'm pretty good at fact checking. It's continuity of voice.
Did you ever find that you, when you're working on a long series like that, have you ever found that you did something in the spur of the moment as you were writing that had great ramifications further down the series that you weren't aware of when you put it into the already published book and now you're stuck with it?
Oh, hell yeah.
From experience.
Yeah, we all do that, don't we? Well, The Thousand, my very first book, which I wrote for, you know, over a long period of time as a very new writer, you know, I didn't think much about it. I had my character, you know, sort of exhort a god. Like she goes, of course, I picked Osiris. Don't ask me why he went Egyptian. So the word occurs once as basically kind of a damn in the conversation. And so I thought, well, I could ignore it. Probably no one else would notice it, but it drove me crazy. So finally, I decided to set it up so that they end up, when they first arrive in human space, they arrive in a bar where somebody swears like that, and it just gets ingrained and they all pick it up. So I had to deal with it. I just couldn't let it go. So far, that was the only, and that's just a really quite a minor quibble. So far, so good. I can't say I've made too many choices that I've regretted in the storytelling process. Remind me of that later. No. How about you?
Yes. There are things that I have put in about, you know, on the spur of the moment about how magic works or something. And then sometime later I'd really like the magic to do this, but I established without really thinking about it 2 books ago that the magic won't do that, and I'm stuck with it, and you have to write your way out of that little problem. But that's just part of writing.
Well, part of it, too, gives you unexpected potential. I mean, I like to put as much in as I can, and one of the things I put in that initially was a bit of a throwaway, but not really to me, but in the book it was that Huido, the giant lobster-esque character from A Thousand Words for a Stranger, has a pool in his suite of rooms on the space station in which he has carnivorous nonverbal wives. And the impression I left readers with was that they were, you know, they were totally non-sentient, but I never meant them to stay that way. So when I started getting a chance to play with that, then of course they become major players in the finale trilogy. And I had so much fun bringing them out of the pool, as it were. But all this time I was thinking about that. I said, wait till people see what they're really like. But I never knew if I would do that. I was just like, I just put it in, because the more you put into a story, the richer it reads. But also when you come back to it, if you do, the more that there's there to play with.
I often say there's always something, you know, even if a book is not intended to be a sequel, there's always enough little loose threads you've left in it that you could go back and write a sequel or write something else in that world. Because the world in this podcast is called World Shapers. The world that you shape is always got blank spots, and here there be dragons off in the distance and things like that. So it's always possible to return to a world and tell more stories in it.
Well, it must. And actually, that's one of the things that our editor in common, Sheila, told me way back. She said, I want to have a sense that the world I'm reading about continues off the page, that there are places that the main characters haven't been, that there are unexplored areas, or even just things that don't get mentioned, but you know that they exist because, whether it's a traitor that shows up that's been somewhere else and talks about it, or just the sense of a fully developed place. So, and that's very important to me too. I think when as a reader, I like that. I like to know that there's an archaeology, there's a history, there's a future.
I wanted to go back to something you said about voice, because I noted in your Facebook postings about Mage that you had said you'd kind of had to put it aside because you were, I think, doing the galleys for the next Essen book.
Yeah.
You had to kind of shut Mage out of your head so that you could stay in the right frame of mind for Essen.
They couldn't be more different. It's really quite bizarre. I mean, she's first person, she's bubbly, she's an adolescent, and then of course Mage is all these, you know, it's not grimdark, but it's certainly, there's adults and they're dealing with big difficult problems, and it's nothing, there's wonder, but it's not that kind. So yeah, it's tricky.
Because you had said you had worked on two different series at the same time.
But they were both science fiction. So
I was going to say, do you typically work on two things, two different projects at the same time, or are you usually more of a one thing at a time
writer? I'm usually working on at least five, but not writing five. And writing is when you sit down to actually create the story, then I'm focused on one thing. But right now, for example, as I said, I'm researching one book. I just finished outlining two more. I've got a short story I'm tossing ideas at, but to actually sit down and write tomorrow, that'll be Mage, and I won't be doing anything else but that until I get up from the writing.
So going back to Mage, can you give some sort of synopsis of what it's going to look like when it's finished? You've mentioned the novella structure, but what's kind of the overall story?
Okay. The overall story is that we encounter Tannanin. It's a country circled by mountains and bordered by a sea that the people who live there don't leave it, and nobody is allowed into it because it is the only place left on the world that contains magic. And that's because at a certain point, those who actually were the embodiment of magic had a destructive battle about what that magic would ultimately be used to do, to create or to enslave or to destroy. And the Deathless Lady, the goddess that the humans call her, is the one holding on to this one spot. And she's basically just lost in a dream of what it was. But people are there and they're pulling this magic out and making these things come to life again. And that can only go so far before something else happens. And at the meantime, the defeated, I won't say defeated so much as those exiled magic consumers, if you wish, that the eaters, she's exiled them into the ocean, and they've been trying to find their way in, and they will. So it's very much a case of, if you want to keep magic, what are you willing to do? And, you know, is there a value to just random beauty or not? So it's very much that kind of a play. So I myself don't know how it will end.
with a story idea and a world that you're building, how do you pull out the characters that you need to tell that story? And
Well, the characters aren't too hard because I have the mage that started Malinario is the mage from the novella that the novella I wrote for Eric Flint is actually it's called Intended Words, Gossamer Mage, and that's the first novella in the book. And in that, he is trying his very, very best to destroy the Deathless Lady and stop this because he's seen so many of his friends turn old and die for nothing, for just the use of magic. And instead of killing her, she turns it around and as matters happens, he's rejuvenated and he becomes the youngest of the mages, and yet he has the knowledge and the power of the eldest of them. So he sets forth on a quest to find and destroy what he thinks is the blight upon the world. So the next novella is Consequential Phrases. And there we meet one of the daughters who serves the Deathless Goddess. And from her side of things, what does the world look like? So I think I'll leave it there. So the characters I've got already, they're pretty well settled.
It's interesting. One of your most interesting characters is, of course, literally just a blob, albeit of an attractive blue shade.
Yes.
That's a fairly unique character.
That's Essen. Yeah. Oh yeah. No. She's a whole lot of fun. Again, it's a case of if you do the right choices at the beginning, and I feel I did there, which was because it's science fiction, I wanted to make her very, believable, credible, how these things can be and how you can have life forms like this and all the things that are consequences of that. So one of the fun things with Essen, of course, is if she picks a form to be, she's going to be the form that she is. And so it's usually not the right choice. So she usually ends up being afraid of the dark in a cave or something like this. So it's lots of fun.
Have you ever had, authors will sometimes talk about minor characters taking over a book or we often talk about it as if we don't actually have control over the characters. do you ever have that feeling?
It's funny with my second book that of the Clan Chronicles, Ties of Power. I came up with a character who is the main character is Morgan, and someone from his past who made him what he was. So I started writing this Simon character, and then I called Sheila and I said, I don't want to kill him off, but I got to kill him off. He's just getting to be too important. Either that or I need another book. And she said, okay. And that was my first experience with Sheila just going, okay, write another book. And I went, pardon? What just happened here? So now I know what happens. If you need another book, well, yeah, write the other book. So that was very liberating. So Simon did get to come to his great comeuppance in the next book. So that worked out.
Well, we can't talk about the completion of Mage because it's not completed yet. But when you do complete a novel, mm-hmm. what does your revision process look like? Do you do a lot of rewriting, or do you do like John Scalzi, who I interviewed earlier for the podcast, talked about doing a rolling draft where he makes his changes as he goes along? I don't work that way. I tend to do a lot of revision after I've written it. So what is it like for you?
I am a little more in John's camp. I think that's partly because of all the nonfiction. I was just used to very much writing. I write to very tight deadline, and I write the best I can the first time around. So I just finish it. I do spell check. Then I send it. And then Sheila comes back with things like, can you explain how that happened? And we could really use seeing a little bit more of their family structure and, that kind of thing, like content. And then I rewrite that and it's done. That's basically my editorial revision process. I do like to read it once in paper because I find I catch flow problems better that way.
I think something I found recently, because I have my young adult series, The Shards of Excalibur, is coming out in audiobook, and I'm not narrating it myself. So I'm doing the proof listening to somebody else reading my words to me out loud. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing the things I find that I missed.
Yeah.
Minor things for the most part, but one or two things, it's like, what was I thinking? Why didn't I catch that? So I sometimes think that we should hire, the people hire beta readers. I think we should hire people to read our books to us out loud. I'm beginning to think might be a good way to make it, catch a few things that you just don't see when you're reading it yourself. Do you use any kind of beta reader or anything like that?
No. To me, there's a certain level. Have I told the story, and have I been generous enough to the reader in terms of what I've provided for the world building, what I provided for scene and description? And I think by having done it, I mean, we've been doing this for a long time. So, I mean, in my case, I've been writing fiction full time for 20 years. So you get a gut feeling. You know, I'll be writing something and then I'll stop and I'll snarl at it and I'll walk away because I have a gut feeling that I really got lazy. So that tells me I go back and I look back at the last three pages or four pages and I say, yeah, I got lazy, and I will rewrite those and continue moving forward. So a lot of it's experience. You know really what you're doing, and a lot of it's confidence, and a lot of it is it can only be so good. I mean, I can pick up any book off the shelf that I've written, and I'm sure I'll find things I'd like to fix or have someone read it to me and I'd say, oh, that's awkward. But if I've told the story I want, and at the end of it, the person feels the way I meant them to feel, and they still love the book, I'm fine with that.
Now, I want to go back to Sheila's process. It sounds like your experience with Sheila is much the same as mine. And people ask what editors do. How would you describe what Sheila does for you as an editor?
I would say Sheila is the ultimate beta reader. She is so experienced, and I don't know how she remembers the details of stuff when she hasn't had a chance to reread all the previous books for so long, but she's still bang on. But she also comes at it with that a sense of what a reader needs. So for me, she's the one who's forever slapping me on the wrist in a very kind and thoughtful way when I've been lazy, when I've left something out, when I've tried to skip over some important revelation. And when I first wrote, I didn't want to go purple. I didn't want to get too passionate. I didn't want to have too much outward emotion. And she caught those right off the bat. She caught where I was avoiding showing a death, or I was avoiding even just showing a love. I mean, even where I was just sneaking by things, and she would stop me doing it. So I think she's got a wonderful instinct for the emotional content, and she's got a great instinct for crap. You do it too. She's training us, so we always try to say, okay, well, I'll never do that again. So what? I don't want to make a new mistake. And for example, for a search image, because she hadn't read the Espen books for a long time, she was perfect because her mindset was, as a new reader coming into this, what do I need to know? And she actually told me what she liked, which is a really big thing. That doesn't always happen, as you know. Mm-hmm. But I found that Sheila found a few things where I had opportunities to enrich stuff that I hadn't actually been paying attention to. I'd been focused on the plot. And so it was quite a few things that were sidelined to the plot, but now will matter now that she's made it a series.
What I find, you know, just like you, you're writing something, and sometimes you think, well, you know, okay, I'm going to let that slide because nobody will notice. Sheila notices.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's often not even something that you address directly, because something twigs and she'll say it. For example, for In the Company of Others, I'll never forget, in that one, I've got people have been stranded on a space station for 20 years, and things are starting to run out and whatever, the situation's becoming dire. She wanted to know about the armaments on the space station. And I went to myself, I went, it's a bus station. It doesn't have armaments. But what she meant was something in her felt that I had not explain why there weren't weapons on the space station. So I did. All I had to do was produce somebody reading the document about what's allowed on the space station and what's not. So to make it clear, it was a civilian, never militarized. It was always just a hub that nobody was supposed to stay at. Like it was modeled on the O'Hare Airport back in the day before security. So, so that's the kind of thing.
Every time I have a book edited by Sheila, it's much the same thing. It's like she just has that laser-like focus on things that you feel as soon as she says it. She says, "Oh, I should have realized that."
And damn, you, as you said,
You're trying not to make the same mistake next time and pick something new to make a mistake about or miss the next time.
Yeah, no, she's very insightful, and it's great to get her feedback. And it's, as I say, it's always noticing the things that aren't quite working or could be better. It's not so much this is how or this is why. It's this is the spot.
So, and she's, it's not a not a line by line edit by any means with Sheila.
No.
Although my copy editor at DAW has occasionally picked up things that I should have caught as well. Have you ever had that experience where something slipped by?
No, not usually. No. But then I was a professional editor for 10 years. So I tend to hopefully not provide too many things they're going to try as quick.
Well, I was going to say, it wasn't that kind of like a grammatical error or punctuation error, because I was an editor too, and was a newspaper editor. In my case, it was just something that I hadn't, and Sheila could have picked it up, but it was actually the copy editor. In the new book that's coming out, World Shaper, which oddly enough has the same title as this podcast pretty much. I had some people sailing off the West Coast, but where I had described them being, they were actually sailing into Puget Sound, and I had them going straight off into the Pacific. And somebody kindly pointed out that they would actually run into land if they did what I explained. So I had to move that.
Wait, the more people that read it and then give you feedback, the better. I mean, that's great. You just reminded me of a great goof I've made over the years. At some point in my life, writing about starships, I began to confuse the word aft and bow. So I would have things that would go, someone would go from the aft to the stern. And of course, aft is another word for stern. But I totally lost that. Nobody picked it up in all the books. It's in almost every one of the Clarion Chronicle books. People have fun with that. Go look at the books. When Roger was doing the cover art for Plexus, he read my description of Plexus from the book and immediately spotted that, came in and said, "You know, this is wrong." I went, "Pardon me?" He said, "But which is it? Which is the rear end? Because you've got two rear ends on your space station." I said, "Oh, dear God. No, really?" And everyone had missed this. And we're talking about 20 years of proofreading. Even readers have never called me on this. So I'm hopefully better now. I know a bow from a stern.
I sometimes have a problem with east and west and forget which way the sun comes up. I don't know what that's all about either. But I'll spot it once in a while.
Well, I feel better now. That's bigger than mine.
You have said, and generally it shows in your writing, although it sounds like the Mage book might be a little darker, but generally you approach your work with a sense of optimism. And, you know, there is a lot of grim, dark writing in the field. And I don't know if it started with George R. R. Martin, but he's right up there.
He's been the most successful with it.
Yeah. Why do you go the other route?
Because I don't like it. I don't believe in it. I don't like it. I mean, if I'm going to pick up something to read, I mean, I'll go back. I will probably read something that is not what I would write because, you know, I really trust the author or it's an interesting story. And I don't mind reading. I love a really good tragedy. There's nothing wrong with that. What I don't like is violence used as pornography. And I don't like the victim mentality. Those things just fire my brain up because in my experience and the way I look at the world, most people muddle along. You know, we're not great heroes, but we're not great villains either. We're usually going to risk, you know, put our hand out to help someone out of a ditch. It's not going to be the other way around. Oh, ha-ha, they fell in a ditch. Unless you yourself are already in trouble. So from my worldview doesn't include, you know, how miserable and horrible can we be. It usually includes what kind of a party can we have even though we can't afford butter. You know, we'll find a way. It always happens. There's always a party. So that's part of it. It's partly what I won't read. But also a book, you're there for a long time. I will write a very dark short story because I'll be in and out of it in 2-3 weeks. But I'm not going to spend 4 months of my life on a daily basis in a dark place. So I think that's the other side of it. I get too engrossed in the work and I don't want to be there. That's not how I want to make my living. Now, people will argue that I killed off everybody in my series at a certain point. But I knew where that was going. So even though that was tough to do, I knew that there was a light at the end of the tunnel because I'm not going to put other people in a place that they can't get out of either.
Yeah, and that's actually very much the way that I kind of feel. I think of myself as an optimistic writer, and then I look at my books and I think, boy, I killed a lot of people in that book. but it doesn't feel dark to me at the end, I guess, is what it comes down to. And that idea of people muddling through, that's always been something that's pretty much describes every character I've written. I think they make all horrible mistakes, but they're always trying to do the right thing, and they muddle through in the end. And I think that's an appealing thing in a story. So I want to ask my opinion of something. One reason this is called The World Shapers, this podcast, it's not just because my new novel is called World Shaper and I'm trying to market it in two ways, but it's also because this whole idea of world shaping is the idea that we're really not building a world. We're taking our existing world and shaping it. And one thing that it strikes me is that even the so-called mainstream writers are no more writing in the real world than a fantasy writer is. They are still taking some element of the real world, but they're shaping it into something new, because no fictional world can contain all the complexity of the real world. So I guess what I'm asking is, do you think that's true, that people who are writing literary fiction or non-speculative fiction are, in a way, they are still crafting a world that's different from our own just as much as we are when we're writing speculative fiction?
No.
No.
Well, I see your point. I do. But when you're writing mainstream, everyday, you know, slice of life type of work, you're relying on your reader being in that world. So you're presenting your piece of it to an expert who doesn't need you to tell them everything that's around, because they know. And to some extent, you can rely on that. You can just use very broad, light brush strokes. You can focus attention on this cafe or that, you know, football stadium. But everybody knows, it's reading that work, everything else about the world at that time. And even when we read older historically set fiction, we still have the ability to go and look around and see all the other parts that are there. So we're really not, those writers have chosen, and it's actually quite difficult, because if you're trying to, say, move from Texas to Alberta or Saskatchewan, and then write about Saskatchewan, you're really struggling, because it's not as familiar as where you were. So writing around where you're familiar is good. Although I have a cautionary tale on that. I know a science fiction writer who set something in Pittsburgh and had this wonderful chase scene that was so accurate you could actually follow it in your car, except they plunked down a new building right in the middle before a book came out. So anyone who tried was just hitting this building. So it really didn't quite work. So that being contemporary SF can be troublesome too.
Yeah, the real world. Well, and I mentioned my Shards of Excalibur books. The characters who are teenagers in a couple of occasions take buses, and bus service since the book came out, the last book came out 2 years ago, the Saskatchewan Transportation Company, the government-owned bus company, has closed down, and now Greyhound is pulling out of Western Canada. So my characters cannot take a bus anywhere. And even though it's supposed to read like it's now, it's already become a historical novel in a way. So yeah, writing in the here and now can be it's almost like when Venus quit being a jungle world and turned into a hot, hellish place.
Well, and we do it in science fiction too. We rely on what the readers bring to us. Because I said earlier, I could say it's a starship, or give one or two clues, and readers of science fiction will have already 90% of what I need them to know, that there's going to be a hull, there's going to be space outside, there's going to be mechanisms. If you've got gravity, that's going to be artificial. So they fill in the blanks for me. So I'm not shaping the world so much as I'm pointing my flashlight on a part of it that I want where I want their attention, as if they're all cats and I've got a little pointer. follow this pointer to this part of it. So to that extent, I feel that we all shape the world as we read, if that helps.
Where do you think the impetus comes from for those of us who write science fiction and fantasy? Why do you think we choose to do that instead of the mainstream set in the real world? Why do you do it? But in general, where do you think that impetus comes from?
Well, I think it's partly because the reason that I wrote The End of Tarzan, because you're not satisfied. You're not getting what you want as a reader. So you're going to write it yourself. I think that, and that's a very true expression of creativity to be very selfish and to write just what you want. And as you do it, and as you discover there are people of like minds, that becomes another exciting level to it. If you're comfortable with that, that you're now writing to yourself and an audience of people who write like what you do. So that's wonderfully fulfilling. But I also think there are so many questions we want to answer as human beings that science fiction lets us play with, and so many things we want to say that we care deeply about that fantasy gives us a platform to say. So to me, those are both very powerful draws to writing science fiction and fantasy. And I think I will always write both for that reason.
When you're shaping your fictional worlds, are you hoping in some fashion to shape the real world, or at least your readers in some way, to change them?
Well, I certainly hope they care more about toads. that was a personal message there. Only in the sense that I want them to, you don't put messages in. What you can only do is put in what you yourself believe. And I believe in muddling, and I believe in complicated endings, that nobody's a winner, that you compromise. It's very Canadian. So my favorite stories are the ones where it ends up with everyone gets what they want, sort of, but nobody gets what they thought they wanted at the beginning. So it just all works. How do you make it work is kind of my great finale feeling at the end of a story. It's along with a lot of happy and joy and all the rest of it, but I want it to work. If there's a message in there, I suppose it's, take care of the planet, take care of yourselves, and be nice to other people.
That's a good message.
It's not bad. It's not bad. It could see you through.
Well, we're to the end here, I think. So first of all, though, before we go, what can readers look for coming from you soon? Now, this podcast will probably be releasing in late August or early September. So what's coming up from you?
I have a busy fall of releases. I do. So in September is the mass market edition of To Guard Against the Dark. Also an e-novella, the first Essence story in a while, called The Only Thing to Fear, introducing Evan Gooseberry, my favorite new secondary character who's taking a whole lot of stage. Then in October is Search Image, the new Essence series starts. It's called The Web Shifter's Library. Then in December, we launch the first, maybe, Tales from Plexus, which is a series of, it's an anthology of a short story set in my Clan Chronicles universe, written by other people, but I've written a novella to blend all the stories into one, so it reads a bit more like a book. So I'm very excited about that. There's some absolutely wonderful stories in there.
So never a dull moment here for the next little while.
No. And then there's more. And then Mage actually comes out next August. So.
Well, that's great. So thanks so much for being on The World Shapers. Where can people find you online?
Cerneda.com. That's CZERNEDA.com. And thanks, Ed. All the best with your stuff, too.
Thank you very much, Julie. That's the end of another episode of The World Shapers. You can find The World Shapers online at theworldshapers.com, also on Facebook, just look up The World Shapers, and on Twitter at @TWorldShapers. You can also find me online, your congenial, I hope, host, Edward Willett. I'm at edwardwillett.com. It's important to know that Willett has two T's, W-I-L-L-E-T-T. You can also find me on Twitter at @ewillett, again, two T's. And you can find me on Facebook, too. Imagine that. That's it again for this episode of The World Shapers. We have many more great interviews in store, so please come back and hear another conversation with another shaper of fantastic worlds about their creative process. Bye for now.